Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, here's another JREP session for you, this one also featuring Emil, Tracy, and myself. And this particular conversation starts with a rant by yours truly related to aligning client expectations with reality and making those guidelines actually stick, which I admit I often find challenging. And then that, of course, led us down the rabbit hole of the differences in pacing between Japan and other countries' property markets, as well as some other more nuanced differences. How do the various communications channels work between all parties involved in the purchase process? How are lowball offers perceived here? Is overbidding a thing in Japan? And we then took the conversation over to Tracy's sphere and continued the discussion with her. How do short-term stay operators handle requests for discounted pricing? Do seasonality and supply-demand dynamics come into play here at all? And also a bit about post-COVID revenge travel, getting the most out of your Airbnb properties generally, catering to large families and groups. And also we touch on legal recourse and documentation in Japan. So really nice, casual, but quite insightful conversation about some very interesting topics. Enjoy the chat, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Recording in progress of the Japan Real Estate Experts panel, back in action again. And I hear Blanca might be joining us. Oops, did we just lose Tracy?
No, I'm here. I just turned off my count and my just wanted to blur my background so you couldn't see my messy office.
Yeah, I hear Blanca, she's been very busy recently, but hopefully she'll be with us either today or next time. Mm-hmm. If no one's got any particular topic, I want to have a rant, actually.
Rant away.
Shall we do a quick introduction first?
Oh, yeah, quick introduction. Yes, please.
I went first last time. You go first, Emil, today.
Okay, cool. My name is Emil. I'm a real estate agent here in Tokyo. If you're looking to buy your family home in Tokyo and interested in purchasing something locally, your local resident, you want to get financing, the typical Japanese financing, please let me know. But yeah, any kind of purchase in Tokyo regarding sort of, you know, a family home largely, or please reach out, sales@realestate.jp. And Ziv, over to you.
And we handle any real estate requirements, sale purchase management anywhere in Japan. We're probably referred to other people in Tokyo, which has wonderful people like Emil. But anywhere else in the country, which is a bit more challenging, regardless of what it is that you'll be purchasing, investment properties, holiday homes, land for development, we're your single point of contact in English for all your real estate Japan requirements. Tracy?
Sure. I am your resident slumlord. No, sorry. I am your resident short-term rental.
Actually, you're the exact opposite of a slumlord.
Well, hopefully, yes. So I actually run a hospitality business, and real estate is my place of business, not my actual business. So I do two things, actually. I host inbound tourists. for a short-term basis. So that is on hotel or minpaku basis. So that's like 2 to 7 days with Tokyo Family Stays. I also have sort of medium stay, so 1 to 6 months furnished serviced apartment rentals. And I have both of those under the Tokyo Family Stays umbrella. And I also help people monetize their short-term rental in Japan and also abroad. So I'm all about the hospitality, and I'm all about maximizing guest experience and also using your guests as to create a beautiful business and beautiful relationship between you and your guests. So yes, I've just come from lunch. I've just had 2 glasses of wine, so if I'm a little bit
Ooh, nice lunch.
I know, I've had a bit of a boozy lunch, so which yeah, you can do as so an
the flow better. The flow will be better, but you might not be entirely cohesive.
Yeah, just put me on mute if I babble on too much.
And if anyone hasn't checked out these two guys, I'm not sure which way the recording will be pointing, but if anyone hasn't checked these very insightful presentations in our recent Japan Real Estate Summit, hop over to our website, nippontradings.com, one word with a double P, and there's a link at the top there to all of these very intelligent and experienced people's presentation, plus a few others, more handsome and maybe less attractive people that are there as well. So yeah, I wanted to have a rant.
Rant away.
So we get this almost primarily with the holiday home shoppers. I don't know if that's the case with people in your respective industries as well, sectors as well. But no matter how much we explain to people how different things work in Japan and how the time frames are going to be, we even recorded a bloody 15-minute explainer video that we sent to everyone purchasing before they engage our services to align their expectations with reality in Japan, which is totally different to what it is overseas. And they go, oh, yes, we get it. And then a day after they've emailed us with our request, we are constantly hit for, so what's up? So what's the status update? Did you hear back from the agent? We're moving to Japan next month and we need everything to be ready by then. Where is the gap that we're not filling here?
Things operate on a glacial pace sometimes here. It does feel very, very slow and methodical. Yeah, there's not a lot of hustle. Because we're dealing with civil servants, right? We're dealing with a lot of sort of government departments, and we're dealing with just the mechanics of how things go. It's very analog.
Or country bumpkin realtors, same story.
Or country bumpkin realtors, where they're still using fax machine. It's 2023, nearly 2024, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it is fax machine.
A month, I think. I'm still doing 20 to 50 faxes a month, depending. Yes. Every time we have basically a client, we'll send them, you know, we say, oh, they're interested in a place in on the Toyoko line. I've got someone right now, Toyoko line. So we send them, you know, 20, 30 listings along the Toyoko line. They pick out the 10 they want to view on like this coming weekend. And we have to fax 10 different agents. Literally, we fax them. And what do we fax them? Sort of my business card. My business card and the information that this is the property, this is the date, the schedule you want to view it, and we fax it to 10 different agents, and then we do a follow-up phone call, and then they get back to us. And if it's an empty property or a vacant property, usually it's pretty easy to schedule, or a renovated place that's there's no one living there. But if the owner is living there, wow, it's really tough to schedule, because the seller's agent needs to contact the seller. And they'll probably contact them, like, maybe not right away, maybe just in the evening or whatnot, or the following day. The seller will check with their spouse if Saturday is okay or Sunday is okay, and then they'll get back the next day. And we've got 10 different properties we're trying to schedule at a different time slots on within like a 6-hour window, right? And to have them
that's
all
the other thing too is the expectation that I get where that's coming from, because I know that definitely in the USA and a lot of the times in Australia, which are the two markets I'm a bit familiar with, realtors, for one reason or another, are so hungry that as soon as anybody contacts them and says, I might want to submit an offer, can you get some information? They'll jump on the phone, they'll make all the calls, they'll talk to everyone, and they'll get back to that person within 20 minutes. we can't work that way. We're a services-based business with, at any given time, over 100 active clients that we're also doing management for. So somebody, just as an example, and they're amazing. They were really, really nice couple, and I really like them. But they emailed me Friday, 4:48 p.m., when all of our staffers who are, you know, the only way to get good bilingual staffers in Fukuoka is to hire working moms. So all of our office staffers are gone. Chikako and myself are working through weekends and evenings, but we're not going to be sitting on our email and checking it every 5-10 minutes. And also, we're not the ones in contact with the agent that you've already been in contact with. That's our staffer. So by the time she gets to the office Monday and sees the request and handles another 15 urgent requests before that, yes, the property might be gone, even though you wanted to submit an offer and get, it's just not physically possible sometimes. Sorry, rant over. I really had to get that off my chest. But I don't know how to align expectations and make it stick. That's what I'm saying, I guess.
I guess everyone's really excited, right? Like, you know, and they want things to, once they've made that decision.
For me, it's, and it happens a lot. It's, if there is a misunderstanding, then I just think the onus is on me to communicate more clearly and communicate, you know, well.
And again, so just and again, say, and again on the same topic with the same person.
Yes, because if they haven't understood it, then my method of communication is not clear. Just because I've written it in an email, then, and they, if they still misunderstand, then okay, I need to re-clarify with them what that is. I find though, if it's in writing, it's easier to go back to and say, well, look, this is the process. So just expect the next communication. So, and often what I've started doing, like what I do is I'll say, this is where we're at. My next communication is going to be at this stage, right? There's nothing I can do between now and then, right? Or what the expectation is. So with typical agents, and you'll know this, Siv, they're closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. That's the industry holiday. So if I get an offer to send on Monday, like on a Monday, and I say, okay, I'm going to submit this to the seller's agent. Chances are he'll either give it tonight, but if it's already late on a Monday, chances are they're going to be off Tuesday, Wednesday. We'll expect to hear by Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Friday, so Thursday
is when back to the office. They've got a bunch of other offers waiting there, right?
Yeah. So at the soonest, Thursday is when we can expect a response. So
I do that. Please believe me. I do that. But I think it's maybe a gap between, you know, logically understanding it and then experiencing it in person when it actually starts happening, right?
Yeah, I think that. And I empathize because I was in that same situation, and that's why I got into this business, is the learning curve I had to go through. I was used to, in Australia, when I bought my house there, I was in the car with the seller's agent, and you know, we sort of, he jumped in the back seat, and because we're waiting, there were a few other people there, and he jumped in the back and I was having a chat with him. I said, look, this is what we can do. This is the offer. He goes, give me a minute. And he jumps out
on
the phone, and he just literally came back, like, you know, 5 minutes later and said, look, this is the counteroffer. Can you go? I said, all right, let's do it. And so it was done in real time. Whereas here, we'll submit a paper offer. Okay, I'm going to take this, like, just say it's we submit it on Monday, on Monday night. The seller's agent gets back to the office on Thursday, because they're off Tuesday, Wednesday. They get there on Thursday. Okay, great. We've seen it. I have a meeting scheduled with the seller on Saturday. So that's when I'll present him with the offers. So hold on, we submit it on Monday and the seller doesn't hear about it until Saturday.
Yeah.
And my buyer is like, well, it's been a week. Come on, don't we get, like, they're thinking, I'll just give them a bit of a low ball, and I want some kind of a counter offer, etc.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's A-K-I-Y-A-M-A-R-T, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
Oh, don't even get me started on the lowball offers, man. Like, the agents just ghost us when we come in with these offers that people are used to submitting overseas.
Oh, yeah. I always have to explain to the sellers, both the buyer and the seller, but the seller, when we do give the lowball offer, even though I say, look, that's too much of a lowball, it's not going to work. And the foreign buyer will insist, no, no, just do the lowball.
Yeah.
I have to explain to the seller's agents, look, foreigners like to start with a low offer and they expect the counter offer. Don't turn around and say, ah, that's just too low. We can't, obviously we're too far away. It's not possible to meet an agreement. They just, often it's culturally, they insist on doing that. So please come back with something, right?
It's amazing that we work with, sometimes, not often, but sometimes we work with a buyer side agent on our end. And one of them, Mika-san, who was here on the podcast a couple of years back, she also does sales. And she got abused by a seller's agent when she tried to submit a lowball offer. Like, why are you even calling me with that shit? You know, it's just not done here.
That's why, again, part of that, you know, that comes with sort of the experience of, you know, I do... like, you know, only foreign clients. So every one of my offers, I kind of have to go through this process to a degree. And so that explanation and that sort of cajoling the seller's agent and making them understand even through the process where we're at and the kind of client that it is, and set the expectations right.
And they still work with you after that? Like they'll take another potential buyer from you after they've gone through that process with you? Because a lot of the agents that we work with just won't be bothered if we try that.
Oh, no, because we do the deal. It's like we're not trying anything strange. It's like, look, this is the formal offer that I've gotten. But understand that with foreigners, it's a starting point. This is not their max. They do have more, but that's what they're starting at because they expect that there's a counter offer game back and forth. So please come back with something just to give us some guidance. And then I have something to work with. So, you know, you want the person to be also aligned with you. Like you want you want to make sure the seller's agent knows that you're trying to work to get the deal done. You have to work for the client, but you're not just really mucking the seller around. So that's why I think being honest with the seller's agent is very important and just saying, look, this is,
of course. I guess it's also a bit different when you're dealing in properties. I mean, your usual price range is probably starts at around Gosen Man, right? Like you would normally not look at
70 plus kind of
thing. 700, 800,000 US. Oh, sorry, at the moment it's more like 600,000-700,000 US. There's not that many inquiries and offers coming in at a fast pace like there are with the cheaper properties, I guess.
Oh, I mean, I think there are, but also look, when we're talking about, you know, the low ball, you know, it might be sort of 8 to 10 million yen, Right. So 2 to 3 million yen discount is, I think, like, it's kind of fair and reasonable.
Oh, you're talking about lowball of what, 10% off?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, that's not what I meant. We get people trying to offer half the price and stuff like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, my clients kind of know that early on that that's not a thing. And I kind of will also educate them that, look, that's not sort of a relative game. There is a point where that's not, it's too low ball. We're like, we're not even going to waste our time. So
that's what I mean.
Yeah. So I have to educate them as well on that. But again, it's a cultural thing because, you know, in Japan, prices are very much priced per square meter and they're very fairly priced. And
that's what we explain as well. The negotiation culture is not a big thing here. I mean, you occasionally get some seller, especially the elderly ones who are still living in bubble days, and they really believe that they can get the price that they, you know, they think the property was worth back in the 90s. But that's just a case of the seller's agent saying, okay, I'll list it at whatever you want. And everybody knows, including the seller's agent, that it's not a reasonable price. But generally speaking, if they have consulted and accepted the advice of the realtor, the properties will be priced correctly. It's not really a negotiation market.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and just sort of to clarify that with to the listeners, what you mean by that is, you know, if an individual seller is listing a property for sale, they'll get an agent to come and represent them, and that agent will give comparables and give a realistic price. And let's say that price is 85 million yen. If the seller says, look, we want to list it for 1.1 oku or 100 million yen, like, you know, 20% markup, the agent's going to say, look, that's just not realistic. How much, like, you know, we can do it, but you're way off. Right? And if you're a serious seller, you're going to realize that that's way off. So maybe 10% high, and then they slowly decrease is something. But the seller should be aware from their agent that they've already priced it well above. So expect that you're going to get offers closer to the market, right? So
if you even get an offer, people will often just skip those listings, right?
Oh, correct. Yeah, that's a good indication of whether or not there's lots of, like, if even with our clients who we're selling for or rentals, you know if it's priced well or not by the number of inquiries that you're getting and viewing schedules that you're getting, right? And if there's just nothing, then they'll go back because the seller's agent wants to make the deal. They don't want to just accept, you know, it costs them money to list the property. The seller's agent costs them money to list it on the databases, and it costs them time and effort. And if it's priced just too high, they're going to advise their client. But in general, it's, you know, they're priced at a reasonable kind of fair market price, maybe a little bit higher, but such that if someone really loves that property and it's in the location that really works for them and checks the boxes in a really good manner, it's priced in a way that that person is willing to pay the premium for this property that checks all the boxes really well.
Hmm.
Right. I think with, and what, you know, we're talking about this lowballing and this the Western approach. One thing that's really interesting is the other side of it, not the lowball offers, but the cap, the price cap. What we don't have in Japan is competitive higher bids.
I thought so too, but then at our first summit when we spoke in February and I pointed that out to the audience, they said, no, in Tokyo, we do get overbids.
No, but like I've never
run across, even when we have somebody who wants to do that, the seller's agent will normally say, no, the asking price is okay. You don't need to do that.
Yeah, like the only time I've experienced the overbids is when... So, and again, just to clarify to the audience, right? If the price is set at 80 million yen, that's pretty much the maximum purchase price for the property. It's not a guidance price. Like in Australia, they'll say a property is $800,000. Like that's a guidance. And then they'll go to auction or they'll get offers for 850, 920,000, etc. The guidance price is $100,000 below the actual price. Whereas in Japan, that for sale price is the kind of almost the maximum price. If I come in with finance approval or finance pre-approval and offer the maximum asking price, offer the full asking price, that's it. It's a done deal.
Yeah.
There's no other bids that come and try to go, oh, I'll give you another 1 million, 2 million, 3 million yen. It doesn't happen. They kind of just lock it in.
How about your customers, Tracy? Do they haggle on the price per night or price per week or price per month or?
They try sometimes. it really depends on the culture. And I have a standard reply. And actually, I wrote a big blog post about this on my blog, because a lot of hosts actually get triggered when the first question they get asked is, Can you give us a discount? because it's like you've put your heart and your soul into it and people are not interested in your hospitality or your service. They just, what's the price? And it feels a little blunt and it feels a little impersonal. And it really comes down to the expectation of the person paying the money. If they're just looking for a cheap place to stay, of course they're going to ask that question. And it just might mean that that person who's asking is not a good fit for you. And I just have a couple of standard replies. So, you know, if I just have someone come to me, first of all, what can I have a discount? I'm like, I'm very polite. I'm not like, you know, I give people the opportunity, give them some grace to be, you know, to turn it around to see if they're a good fit for me, because I'm checking them out as much as they're checking me out. So I'll, I'll write to them and say, look, you know, I actually use a dynamic pricing software. We're very comfortable with our pricing. We feel it's a fair price for the value that we're offering because of blah, 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 you know, because this is what you're getting from us. If this is not comfortable for you, then that's fine. You know, it may not be a good fit. But
it is also cultural, though. You're right. I noticed that there are particular countries where it's just part of the culture.
It's just part of the culture.
And I originally Middle Eastern, haggling is a way of life, right?
Exactly. And it's no shade or it's no, like, you know, it's no disrespect meant. But unfortunately, you know, it's a sort of cultural awareness from the part of the host to be like, okay, well, like, let's not get triggered about that. Let's let's try and make sure that they're a good fit. And you know what, more often than not, when I come back with my standard, very, you know, kind and respectful, you know, explanation of our pricing policies, people will either like really like the place and book it anywhere, or they'll go somewhere else. So either way, it's fine. But I don't think it's a good practice for hosts anyway to immediately turn around and go, oh, you want a discount? Okay. Because that's, as a business owner, that sort of basically shows that you're either desperate or you, it's signaling,
you're priced
to,
it too high.
Signaling to the market that you're over, that you think that you're overpriced.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in, fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which, if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
So either of those are not, you know, it's not a desirable. I don't want a discount to get people in my door. I think that what I'm offering at the price that I'm offering, I'm comfortable with that, that it's a good price. And, you know, often bargain hunters, they're not interested in what I've got. So I don't necessarily need their business because I've got the mindset there's plenty of customers out there. Let's keep the calendar open for the people who are going to want what I'm selling.
Trace, what's your thoughts on that? If that's, you get that same sort of discount request, but it's a long-term stay, 4 weeks, 8 weeks.
So I always make sure that there's, you know, I've, keep some things in my back pocket. I'd much rather add value. I'd much rather make sure that it's a win-win. Sure, if you're going to come and you know spend five
like
weeks
and breakfast or something like that.
Yeah. So it really, I'm open to negotiation on a value. But from the get-go, when someone just goes, "Can I have a discount?" That's a bit of a red flag for me. But if someone comes to me and they go, "You know what? I really love your place. I think it's a really good fit. It's just slightly out of my budget." So I'll try to work with them with their budget, or I'll
save them
figure
cost
out
elsewhere, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll try to figure out a win-win so that I'm not just bending over right from the beginning, right? Because I'm really comfortable with the price that I'm offering. I'm really comfortable that that's a good market price.
Yeah, when I had my Airbnb properties as well, I think it was 12 at the peak. I experienced different versions of that, and some of them that they're there for 2-3 nights and they want a discount. Yeah, no, that's not reasonable. But I get some that say, "Look, we want to stay for 3 weeks, but we're gone for 3 days in the middle. We're going to Osaka.
Mm-hmm.
We want to come back. Like, what can we do that we don't want to sort of stop and then rebook and have that 3-day empty window? And we have to pay the cleaning fee, but they don't want to just pay for 3 nights unnecessarily. And for me, that 3 nights is hard to fill, right? On a 2 week stay, I'd rather have them stay for the full 2 weeks and say, "Okay, you know what? I'll give you those within that 3 weeks. Fine. I'll give you like 2 days worth for free so you can leave your stuff." And yeah, I think that's kind of the balance that you pay person by person.
It's how you frame it though as well.
Oh, definitely. I love your place is the first line to any message to any host.
Yeah. It's very seasonal as well, right? I'm guessing you'd be more flexible at off season, right?
There's zero off season. There's like peak season and more peak right now.
Right now,
it's peak season or it's hanami. So there is zero, like, because there's ebbs and flows throughout the year. It's not, Tokyo is not seasonal. It's not like the ski fields or you know, other places. It is pretty constant with different waves of inbounds depending on, like at the moment, it's all Australians coming in on their summer holidays, right?
Yeah.
All of them. Like they're coming for skiing, they're dropping into Tokyo for a couple of days before they go to the snow. So they're in and they're out. During the summertime, we get a ton of Europeans because they get like 7 weeks off for the summer, and they usually or university professors, you know, they come and like, you know, set up camp for 4 weeks. Around the end of January, we're getting a big influx, usually, not pandemic notwithstanding, we get a big influx of the Chinese New Year travelers because that's in that sort of end of January. February, we've got a whole bunch of Tokyo Marathon people. So it really, there's all different stuff depending on, you know, whatever is happening in that local country.
Are you still feeling the post-pandemic revenge travel wave?
I know the hotels are. Hotels, like I was just having a conversation this morning, hotels that were 40,000 yen per night. This is like Park Hyatt, for example. 40,000 yen per night are six for a regular hotel room. They're $1,600. For like a bog standard hotel room in the Park Hyatt. So hotels are like off the charts, especially the five stars. And then of course it goes down from there. You know, different like the Apa hotels, they're full, but they're living in a shoebox. Revenge travel, yeah, it's still, I'm putting on properties every month and they, as soon as I'm listing them, they're booking. So
I'm going to Chiba this weekend, and even on a Saturday night, I could still get a decent business hotel for less than 10,000 yen a night. So maybe it's just the cheaper end of the market.
Business hotels, yeah. So, but I mean, during the pandemic, I was in Sendai in a business hotel for like 3,000 yen a night.
Yeah, same in Fukuoka. With breakfast. We had some nice family holidays during the pandemic.
With breakfast, right? Like you kind of, you know. Who can get a buffet breakfast for under 3,000 yen now? When, yeah, so it's a different world now. But yeah, revenge travel is definitely a thing. It's still not much domestic appetite. And, you know, I was at an Airbnb Bonenkai just the other day and, you know, talking with a lot of other hosts, everyone's the same. It's just like happy days. We're all, you know, we're all very happy and we're all like, you know, doing our best to really, you know, solidify our, you know, our market.
You had a very crappy 3 years.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Well, I had to exit because of it. Right?
Yeah, you exited. And there's a lot of people who exited. 100%. A lot of people exited. And now there's, and I'm picking up clients who are entering the market now and entering the market in a nice way. I've just got some clients that are doing kind of higher end. They're sort of from the hotel world and they're, you know, they're taking over buildings now and converting them into short stay, kind of executive short stay, because places like Oakwood are losing their warmth. They're just so busy that their hospitality standards are kind of slipping, or they're, you know, okay. So there's a lot of space in that upper, that premium end, short stay corporate. I'm helping them with some really, really beautiful properties, very high end designer furniture. You know, high thread count sheets, sort of hotel standard, but with a short-term rental amenities. So it's a really nice place, which is different market than Tokyo Family Stays, which is all family tourists. So it's really, the market is segmenting and it's niching, and you pick a lane and you double down on that lane and like really look like, pick a customer and go after that customer and look after everything that they need. And because you'll fill your calendar, you won't need to appeal to everybody because you'll be full with your ideal client. So
that was honestly the
nice
best
to see.
In any industry, that was the best business advice I ever got, I think, is like, don't be afraid to own a niche. It feels like there's not enough customers out there for you, but there's nobody else serving them.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is like the very, very high end, there's not enough, you know, like hotels, bog standard hotels charging $1,600 a night. If you can be offering like a larger place with kitchen that still has all of those amenities and more, then you're in a good space. So I think there's too many like small studios, you know, the 1Ks or smaller, that's sort of driving that, that's keeping that end of the market small, like price-wise small. They're easier to get into, they're a lot lower barrier to entry, but I think it's a race to the bottom in terms of pricing. So own that niche.
I spoke to a European a couple like a two business owners. They own a company together, and they're bringing in working holiday makers from their country to places in and around Tokyo. And they were looking, as they're growing, the kind of rentals that they were doing, which was similar to what you're handling, are just not cutting it anymore because they got groups of 30, 40, 50 coming in at a time. So they were talking about renting a place that they could just rent and then, you know, put their people in there. But they were not aware that you can actually get very affordable properties to buy. Like within a year or two, you'd be much better place to just buy it instead of renting it.
Look, there's bigger groups coming in for sure. And but I have seen just this week, a minpaku operator who has a 5-bedroom house, 1 bathroom, 2 toilets, 24 people they're trying to say that they'll fit in. And I'm like, this is not safe.
No.
This is like, where are people going to put their luggage?
There are actually laws about this.
Well, they're licensed, though. They have a license. They have the minpaku license. But is it prudent? Is this good for the neighborhood? And with that sort of pricing, because if you're going to be offering a group of 24, I've done the numbers, you were better off offering a higher margin than offering more beds, I think, because of the wear and tear of the building. Because you think, I'm just going to pile a whole bunch of people in there, but that's a short-term mindset. You look long-term for your reviews, for the wear and tear in the building, for the safety, people who are going to have a good stay and want to come back and tell their friends. So all of those things are important when you consider your business model, and think, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint, and putting 24 people into a house.
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area. So Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's ARKReform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
House that has a dining table that only sits 6 people and no living room, and just, you know, like they're crawling, they're just places to sleep. That's like 24 people sharing a bath, sharing a shower. It's not
tough even during my backpacker days. I wouldn't want to live that way now.
No, but at least, you know, a hostel, there would be like 4 showers, right, that you would share. You wouldn't, and more than one, more than 2 toilets for that many people. I just thought it was a very disappointing guest experience. But like, you know, they own their own business. So I hope, you know, they'll learn either or they won't. So
I recall with my properties, you would have, groups of like, often will be like Malaysians and Thai.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite common that, you know, when they have these large groups of like, you know, 15 kind of people, then what it is like generations. So the grandparents, you know, 2 or 3 of their kids, and then their grandkids, right? So there's like, you know, basically like 3 families or 2-3 mm-hmm. families, grandparents that come to stay. So it's not just, oh, hey, 24 back to like 15 backpackers coming, staying in. It's a family that they want to kind of stay in there. And so their dynamic with each other is different. And also it could be not too dissimilar to that's their household that they're in back home as well. So I think, yeah, look, if it's, or the other one that I'll get is a group of university students that want to come, and that's their group. With that, it'll be often like just like Tokyo based. Oh, sorry, like people like local Japanese. Because it's hard. You don't usually get 10 university students from another country coming together. Maybe four to six, but the big group of that is like some like, you know, the tennis club or something like that. They want to come domestically. But yeah, you know, it's so I can agree with what you're saying at some point. And then there are certain numbers that just become excessive.
Yeah.
But what we think from maybe the Western perspective is that feels a bit large and hard from what we're used to with our idea of a nice travel experience. Is they're like, well, let's just move the entire home, the whole family, everyone in this household, come and do, oh, wait, we found a house, we can all do the same. We know how to live together. We know how to do it.
I understand that. I get that. But just the wear and tear on the house as well. And you know, how you set up the property for, I always look at a house, I look at the flow of a house, like how are people going to get from the front door to the bedroom with their luggage, that they're not going to bang into furniture, or they're not going to have to go through an obstacle course, or how is it that it's going to be a very like comfortable existence. I probably, you know, my houses, I would have maybe enough for 12 people, for example, but I would only advertise it for 10 or less. That's still a lot for a 4 or 5 bedroom house on a long-term basis. And so, yes, there are more people overall in than you would have long-term. But, you know, 24 in something that size is, to me, is, well, and that's just not how I host.
There is a limit. There's a limit to our time as well, by the way. I'll have to go in a minute. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's just, you know, but back to your original rant, Ziv, let me just sort of tie that up in a bow with how long things take here and managing expectations. I'm just getting some licensing done on a property that I took in August. It is now December, and that I had to do a lot of retrofitting and, you know, security things and getting new carpet that was fire safe. So I also try to manage my potential clients' expectations of how long it takes. You can't, like in other countries, you would, you know, if you do a rental arbitrage model, you'd rent a property, put furniture in over a weekend, take photos and list it, and it'll be ready the next week or the next month, for example. Not here. So if cash flow is tight, then you need to have enough runway for 6 months of, you know, of before you get a license, because it does, things happen at a glacial pace here. Bureaucracy, red tape and paperwork and faxes and teeth sucking and all those things. But
the chantoness of it.
But once that's done, when you know the game and you've got, you know, then there are opportunities. For sure. But yeah, managing expectations of our, and I spend the same amount of time as you do, Ziv, with clients going, oh, I'll just get a holiday house and like list it. It's like, no, not so much. Or I'll just get an apartment. Apartments are cheap. It's like, not so much. So so just managing expectations.
But thank you for allowing me to take all of that off my chest. I needed that.
Fair enough.
But this is a safe space with our tens of thousands of viewers, but still.
Customer service business. We have to deal with customers and try to manage their expectations so they're satisfied and happy and not no surprises. We are that lubricant.
And there's occasionally, not much, but there is occasionally some funny business on the Japanese side. Don't let it be all the bad foreigners. We do run across some bad apples on the Japanese side as well. But I do have to say, to Japan's credit, there's a lot less of them than there are in other countries.
Yeah, I'm quite confident I'm comfortable dealing with agents. Some of them have bad attitudes, but in terms of the process, there's no a way where they can really scam or lie or trick the buyer. Too many regulations and securities places and people involved with our agency, the seller's agent, regulation, the bank, the scrivener, there's no point where there's too many licensed individuals involved that you can't, like I say, there's too much oversight.
Occasionally, like the couple that we met when I was staying in Tokyo for the summit, that we met for lunch the next day, Tracy, we had the agent do a remote viewing for them with us also joining via Zoom. And we were all but ready to go ahead and commission an inspection and put in a purchase offer. And they just because they happened to be in that area when they were visiting Japan, they drove over to have a look at the property. And the dude just skipped a lot of areas in the remote viewing that were of concern. So, no known issues with this property. Let's just not look at that wall over there, and I'll just go on from this side. So it does happen, but it is rare here.
Oh, no. What I find, and you guys may not experience this, but I do, is that I'm a foreign woman here, and some of the agents that I have to deal with sometimes are very, very patronizing, quite abrupt, and used to speaking to me a certain way, and I'm like,
Yeah, Chika gets that. Realize too,
I'm a CEO here, dude.
Exactly. It's more a case of the woman than the foreigner. Chika gets a lot of that too, but she very quickly cuts those connections.
I get that too, to be honest, though. I don't think it's so much foreign or gender based as much as some agents just have a poor attitude. They're straight up salespeople. They're only focused on making their commission and meeting their targets, and so they just completely, rude, no customers. They don't care about the seller, they don't care about the buyer, they don't care about their interaction.
Very sustainable business model, though, is it?
I hate like those kind of agents. There are some agencies that are one particular one that I just hate every interaction with. And I will, and these are even different branches of it. It's one of the big ones as well. And I will, if there is sometimes one property will have, three or four different listing agents. They won't be exclusive. They would have gone to three or four of them, or even just two.
You just avoid that one.
And if I see they're one of them and there's another one, I always choose the other option regardless.
Yeah, we got a few of those too that we just, as soon as we see their name on the listing, let's try to find that property another way.
Yeah. We're talking, you got to wrap up. We're talking about niches very quickly. So I got my Tokyo Dad's podcast t-shirt on.
Yeah, I was going to mention that before we sign off.
That is a niche podcast. So conversations with foreign dads in Tokyo, but also Ziv. I want to get you on it. I've been a bit slow from my initial plan, sort of, 6 or 8 months ago, to try to get this really off the ground and rolling. But I'm putting it out there in sort of publicly on display that it's going to be.
Are you going to get Ash on? Like,
you're not Ash, but Ash is one. Yeah, foreign dads in Tokyo.
I'm kind of more the dad, I think, sometimes at now.
By the time we publish this one, I'm sure it'll be up and running, Emil. I'm still about 5-6 months behind. But like you mentioned in the last episode we recorded about it, it's the name is Tokyo Dads because it's catchy, but it's basically dads in Japan, right?
Yeah, largely foreign dads in Tokyo. But so far, I've spoken to even Japanese dads that are often like what I think is interesting, being a foreign dad in Tokyo is we're trying to raise our kids, and often it'll be a mixed kid. We have either a Japanese spouse or they're being raised in Japanese culture, but we're trying to keep some of the Western culture alive with them. So they're being born as like mixed, or they're being raised as a mixed race or mixed child.
Third culture.
So that the adults, if it's a Japanese adult, it will be someone who is, maybe they grew up in that mixed environment. Maybe they were raised overseas. Right. So it's someone who, hold on, they've been through the experience of being schooled overseas in a Western country and then coming to experience the Japanese culture and then going through the Japanese education system. So they have insight as to what our child will experience. They're sort of a version of our kids. So what's going on with that? They've experienced what our child is going to go through. So I think they are a world of information as well. So it's not just dads, foreign dads in Tokyo. It is everything, but yeah, that's kind of my focus because I am a foreign dad in Tokyo.
Looking forward to tuning into that one. Definitely will subscribe. Speaking of which, like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe. Excellent.
All right. Thanks for your time, folks. Talk to you again soon.
Bye.
So there you have it. Nice little peek behind the curtains there of us, Japan real estate and hospitality service providers, and the things that we deal with as we navigate this cross-border, multicultural landscape and really try to bridge the gap between Japan's property market and the rest of the world. Hope you found some value in this episode. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.